Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care. Working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Every Thursday, join us for a personal tour of Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S., a show co-hosted by HWC founder and homeopath Debbie Brock and attorney at law Alan Phillips. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your thoughts and questions. Let's go!
I'm Debbie Brock, founder of Homeopathy World Community, speaking with our regular weekly Thursday co-host, Alan Phillips, attorney at law, vaccine expert in exemptions and waivers. Today is Friday, January 20th, 2012, and I want to thank all of our listeners for getting on board and helping to share this information with your friends, your family, your neighbors, to anyone who is interested in really learning the other side of the vaccine complex issue that we have going on in the United States today. We have a lot of hot topics that we're going to be talking about, some quotes, and whatever comes up in the news, Alan knows all about it. Hi, Alan.
Hey, Debbie. I'm not sure all, but I certainly do have a lot of information come my way, and I'm happy to have the opportunity to share at least part of that weekly here with you at Homeopathy World Community's Thursday Vaccines and Your Rights radio show.
Yeah, and even though it's Friday, it's still a good day to keep learning and talking about this issue just because of scheduling conflicts. We're here today. I want to also tell people that they can become part of this educational movement by contacting you, learning about the resources and the links like NVIC and your pandemicresponseproject.com, where you post news and information. You also have an ebook that helps people wade through the maze of vaccines. And we ask folks out there to email other people about what the show is, Blog Talk Radio, Homeopathy World Community. Put a tweet on Twitter, share a button on Facebook, click it up to dig and stumble upon Reddit and MySpace. There's so many ways that you can share. You can even copy the embed code for each of the shows and put it onto your website so people can visit you and listen right in and maybe have a conversation about what we're talking about. It's about your freedoms and rights and the options that you have, no matter where you live in America. So we're going to get started with, I think I have a quote here, by Vera Scheibner. She is an author. She is a PhD. She has written Vaccination, 100 Years of Orthodox Research, shows that vaccines represent a medical assault on the immune system. And that is the name of her book. A quote from her is, vaccination procedures are a highly politically motivated non-science whose practitioners are only interested in injecting multitudes of vaccines without much interest or care as to their effects. Data collection on reactions to vaccines is only paid lip service, and the obvious ineffectiveness of vaccines to prevent disease is glossed over. The fact that natural infectious diseases have beneficial effect on the maturation and development of the immune system is ignored or deliberately suppressed. Consequently, parents of small children and any potential recipients of vaccines and any orthodox medications should be wary of any member of the medical establishment. And in parentheses, which is little more than a highly politicized business system, unparenthesized, extolling the non-existent virtues of vaccination. That is a quote from Vera Scheibner. Highly political, highly, conflict-oriented, because there are people on the other side who I talked to just the other day. I got smallpox. We don't have smallpox. I got polio vaccine. I don't have polio, and it wiped out that disease. And so we see she really is on the other side of the issue there, and she even calls it a non-science. Okay, take it away, Alan.
Yeah, Vera Scheidner was highly influential in the early days of my own investigation as a parent into the vaccine issue. She was at one time a senior researcher for the Australian government with some 90 or more published papers to her, peer-reviewed published papers to her credit. She was not looking at vaccines or looking for any issues one way or another with vaccines when she stumbled onto the issue. She was looking at SIDS, sudden infant death syndrome, and had a project that was called Cot Watch. And she was monitoring the breathing patterns of infants in the first few weeks of their lives, and discovered quite unexpectedly a direct correlation between vaccination and radical changes in infants' breathing patterns. And when she looked at research on vaccines and SIDS, even the studies that claimed to show no correlation between vaccines and SIDS at all, when you looked at the data in light of her information, she was able to show that, in fact, there was a very direct correlation. And she concluded from that research that vaccines cause, I think, 50% or more cases of SIDS. What she found was just not that, and it's interesting the way she phrased this, that each child serves as their own control in the sense that you watch the breathing pattern and it's perfectly stable and normal before vaccination. Then on the day of vaccination, the breathing pattern changes radically. But not only on the day of vaccination, there were periods of times, days and weeks after vaccination, where the breathing pattern became erratic again. And this became predictable in relation to the day of vaccination. And so what she found, for example, there were patterns of SIDS, there were clusters of SIDS deaths that were all within a very close proximity of the same time from the date of vaccination. I believe there was a cluster somewhere around the two-week period. And there was also, in her research, a shift in the breathing patterns 2 weeks later after the vaccines, and then as much as 30 days or more later again. And she would see clusters of SIDS deaths at these times following vaccination, but in relation to the date. And so with individual children, the erratic breathing pattern would be consistent over a period of time after vaccination, days and weeks. What would change would be the amplitude, in other words, the degree of change, so that with some children, the irregular breathing patterns would not be so severe as to cause the child's death, but in other children it was. But we would still see an erratic change at the same time period, 2 weeks and 30 days or whatever the exact days were, and I don't remember at this point, but periods of times. So there were spikes in breathing irregularity and breathing difficulty at predictable times following not only on the day of vaccination, but following the date of vaccination. And so you can see why people who weren't looking at, did this child die X number of days after vaccination or something very close to that point, consistent with Dr. Scheidner's research, or they would just say, well, this happened, a period of weeks after vaccination, so clearly it's not related. But her data shows that it is. And, of course, that information has been broadly suppressed or denied by mainstream medical interests, which includes, unfortunately, our governments here and abroad.
Well, I think she touches upon the most important issue, that it is political, politically motivated. And she says that the data is not really being presented in the way that is scientific. It's not objective, and that you're not seeing the total picture. So it is important that those people who are in the field and watching these children become affected, gather forces and speak up and make just, you know what, just like the SOPA issue and the PIPA issue, we just had an incredible stance by the world and the United States. The English version of Wikipedia went dark for 24 hours and 200 million people were participated and so many hundreds of thousands of millions actually of websites went black, and it made a huge, huge statement. So I think in the same way, those people who are behind this effort of getting the truth out needs to have some sort of an action, a global action all at once, so that you hear that the shot around the world kind of thing.
Well, that's what we're going to need, I think, eventually, or not eventually, as soon as possible with the vaccine issue, for more people to recognize what's going on. I'm happy to say that I continue to hear about more and more medical doctors who are speaking out, more and more that I had not heard of previously, you know, new people, new at least to me, coming into the arena. The word is spreading. People are catching on, but there still is this widespread complete denial. And it's just mind-boggling. There was somebody who was an Obama appointee who was just very recently confronted. So, you know, you still believe that crazy nonsense about vaccines, you know, causing autism. That's already been disproven, you know.
Mm-hmm. I hear that, too.
Let's get on with life. And yet, just last year, there were several events, including published medical studies, that point directly to a vaccine autism connection and or bring into great question the anti-vaccine autism connection point of view. So it's clearly politically based. Dr. Scheibner is absolutely correct on that point. It clearly is politically motivated. Politically, policy and law is based on politics, not on science. And in fact, published medical studies are increasingly not scientific and reliable as well, as we see when, for example, the Cochrane Collaboration does independent reviews of, among many other things, flu vaccine literature, and finds that the data supporting the vaccine is slim to non-existent, but the widespread, they see widespread evidence of manipulation of the conclusions. And so what goes on in the practice of medical science is less and less anything about true science and more about who stands to profit by controlling the appearance and outcomes of studies as opposed to what actually happened in the research and the data.
And who's in power and who has influence and all of these other things. So go ahead, let's go ahead and talk about this compensation for narcolepsy for those folks who have taken the swine flu. And this is not just a one-time thing. This has been going on for a couple of years now. There's been incidents of narcolepsy.
We've been talking about narcolepsy since early in the swine flu pandemic, and I first saw information about this in Scandinavian countries.
Right.
The article we're talking about this morning, or this afternoon, I should say, is from Finland, and about Finland. They're kind enough to have a page in English for those mm-hmm. of us who don't read and speak Finnish. It's been an issue there from early on, and there's been questions about compensation and periodic articles about the possible connection, denial of the connection, confirmation of the connection, and so forth. And so they're at the stage now where they're already compensating, I think the figure here is 78 children, narcolepsy. And narcolepsy, by the way, Debbie, maybe you have a clearer or better definition, but it's a condition where you sort of spontaneously fall asleep. And, of course, there are many different levels of severity. Some people it happens to infrequently and very briefly, others more frequently, or, you know, deeper, longer sleep or what have you. I'm sure there are many variations. But it's a debilitating disease. I mean, it not only can prevent you from having a driver's license or functioning reliably in any job situation. Of course, it could undermine a potential for personal relationships as well. It's really kind of a unique situation in terms of its ability to just basically undermine all areas of your life.
The problem with it, it's long lasting. That is a big problem. I wrote a blog about it in August of 2010 under the epidemic and pandemics diseases category on Homeopathy World Community. And we also have there not only the article and the information from the Ministry of Social Affairs and Health. Let me see what country he is from. Partnin, from Finland again. Yes, this is in Finland. This was in early on. And one of our physicians on the network has kindly posted some of the complete repertory chapters on convulsions and spasms after vaccination, the generals for when you get a vaccination, what remedies, homeopathic remedies are appropriately taken. And Thuya is one of the main ones for that. But then he's also listed extremities paralysis afterwards. So I'm not exactly sure what else is attributable and how we would look up narcolepsy. That would be a good investigation for me to do regarding falling asleep. And the problem is that these side effects are long term.
Well, it's not something you want to deal with, to be sure. But in any case, Finland is finally, a couple of years later, getting around to where now they're making payouts to these children and families. Children who are under 18 will get a small payout now and additional money when they're 18, and people 18 and over, according to this article, are getting a full payment. But the payment is intended to address both the short-term suffering and the long-term disability, you know, the effect it's going to have on their lives. But
So when they do this, this is a an acceptance of fact that it is the vaccination is responsible for these side effects, for this disease. That's what it says. Is that correct?
That certainly is a very reasonable interpretation. And in addition to our compassion for the people affected, the huge message here for the rest of us in the world is exactly that, Debbie, that this is acknowledgement of a severe problem that was a result of a vaccine for a disease that we now know was blown way, way out of proportions. This disease turned out to be less problematic than the seasonal flu, and if we had not had the ability scientifically to distinguish the strains of flu, no one in the world would ever have known there was any so-called pandemic. You know, that 2009-2010 flu season would not have been seen as any different from any other flu season, and yet this swine flu was given the highest level pandemic rating that the World Health Organization has. It makes you wonder what they would do if we had a real pandemic happen on the planet. You know, they would have to invent three or four more levels above their last level based on the way they judge this. But in any case, and the articles, by the way, that we're talking about today are articles that are linked from, unless otherwise noted, as Debbie just did with an article on Homeopathy World Community, articles linked on the news page of the Pandemic Response Project, and that's at pandemicresponseproject.com. So, yes, we can safely say, and could, you know, for some months now, but even more so now, that, yes, the swine flu vaccine does cause and has caused narcolepsy. Now,
can you pronounce that one for me, that French word, GNBR? I can't pronounce it.
You know, I keep asking people the correct pronunciation, and I keep forgetting it. But it looks like, if you were to pronounce it phonetically in English, Guillain-Barré syndrome, something like that. And we'll just both have to apologize to listeners.
Yes. Oh, I need to brush up on my French. Okay.
Well, if you have something to brush up on, you're ahead of me.
Yeah, okay. So anyway, did you have any more to say about that particular issue, or do we want to go with the next topic on today's agenda?
Let's move on, Debbie, because I want to touch lightly on several topics, because there have been so many things. This vaccine issue, the larger vaccine controversy, just has so many different pieces that are unfolding constantly. So we're going to touch on several of those for the rest of the show today.
We don't have a lack for news, that's for sure.
Exactly.
Okay.
So this next one comes from Dr. Meryl Nass, who's a medical doctor in Maine, and she has been and become in recent years one of the world's experts on the anthrax vaccine, and she's very much aware of underlying politics and corruption and other problems, and so she has that frame of reference that she has found in her own research, and another piece of that here with this article. So the title of her article, Mental Scores Decline Precipitously at 30 Months After Anthrax Vaccine, but CDC spins study to say the vaccine is safe. Dr. Nass points out that a new paper on anthrax vaccine safety, presumably published to support the Department of Health and Human Services' desire to test the vaccine in small children, which has been a very controversial question about whether to start testing the anthrax vaccine on children. And the authors in this study, Dr. Nass claims, have published papers of very poor quality in the past supporting the so-called safety of the anthrax vaccine. And she goes so far as to say she doesn't understand why they still have careers, that the quality of the research has been so poor. But she says in this particular study, we have this so-called scientific paper in which none of the analyses achieve statistical significance. She says, great work, guys. How do you get the chutzpah to even submit something like this for publication? This is how critical she is of this, and in her estimate, how poor the research is, that there isn't really even anything that reaches a level of statistical significance. But she said the only analysis that comes close to significance shows appreciably worse mental functioning in those who received anthrax vaccines in 30 months, that's 2.5 years after getting the vaccine, relative to the controls. And it's just sort of disturbing that we would find that kind of a result, and apparently that is downplayed or ignored in the study.
Who makes decisions as to what goes forward when data of this nature is put forth before? Is it congressional committee? Is it put before science bodies of science and research and development for these vaccines? Is it before the WHO, the World Health Organization? Where does this information go? Who hears about it? And who makes decisions about whether this type of testing on young children for the anthrax should continue? And it seems unethical to do it in the first place.
Well, there's a so-called peer review process for medical research to be published. This has to be reviewed by peers that have to see that the proper scientific procedures were followed, that the conclusions are supported by the data, and supposedly anything that passes this peer review process is validated as being good science. But we see more and more in recent years people speaking out, people rather the mainstream practice of medicine, for that matter, speaking out, complaining that the peer review process is flawed, that it's not working, and that in fact it's politically driven and not science based. And you know, this raises very serious problems. And I know, as I've said in the past on this show, that there's a Dr. Marcia Angel from Harvard University who spent 20 years as an editor for the New England Journal of Medicine. I mean, who better to know how the industry works than somebody who's an editor of a major medical publication like that? And she went so far as to say in 2008 that we can no longer trust the medical literature and medical authorities who rely on it.
Right. Well, you know, yeah, go ahead.
Well, no, just again, because it's driven by financial interests and not by objective science.
Yes, and one of the situations that I'm seeing here as you were reading this paper or about the fact that the scientific paper says none of the analysis achieves statistical significance. The problem with making a statement such as that and letting the media read it, they come out and post headlines, conclusions that people take at their word instead of actually investigating what was the data and putting forth the real numbers, and so that people can make their own individual conclusion rather than just being handed something and having it, as she said, having it spun to fit the needs of those people who want to continue on doing this work in, I guess it's anthrax because of bioterrorism.
Well, as a society, there's not time for, you know, all of us to review and look behind everybody else's work. And, of course, many of us lack the training and expertise to do that in specialized areas, medicine and otherwise. And so we necessarily have to rely on others to do that for us. But inherent in the act of allowing someone else to evaluate information for us is the possibility that someone will take advantage of that and misuse or abuse that position. And that's, of course, exactly what happens probably just about everywhere that power and authority exists to one degree or another. One of the things that enables that to happen so broadly and pervasively in the United States, as I have increasingly come to believe is the reality, is the fact that we all are raised thinking that we are a quote-unquote free society where things like that can't happen. So when somebody says it is happening, the immediate knee-jerk reaction of many of us is, of course it's not. This is a free society. That doesn't go on here. And yet, ironically, it's the belief that we're a free society that becomes the cover that enables abuse of those freedoms to occur. In some regards, I think even more easily and more severely, perhaps, than in at least some other political systems. But in any event, regardless of the merits or ultimate truths of that position, the fact is that vaccine policy and law are clearly not based on objective science. When we have objective science that directly contradicts the policy and law that seems to never see the light of day, at least in mainstream media and other mainstream circles, and then we have the underlying conflicts of interest and so forth, which help to explain how and why that suppression of objective information occurs. But Dr. Nass's closing of this article sums up rhetorically with a couple of questions here.
Okay.
She says, where is peer review? Why have we allowed spin to be exchanged for scientific discourse? And we can
she,
leave those...
she would definitely be in harmony with Vera Scheibner in terms of calling it politically motivated non-science. So it actually is a perfect match.
Well, I don't know any medical doctors who have truly taken an open-minded look into the issue who have come away saying, I don't see any problems. I don't know of any who have done that. But all the ones that do feel there are problems are ones who have taken the time themselves. See, doctors tend to rely, and in a perfect world they should be able to. We just don't happen to have that perfect world. They rely on the conclusions of studies. Doctors don't have the time to go back and look at the data and see if the conclusions support the data and so forth, to go back and second guess. They need to be able to pick up a journal, read a summary and conclusion, and then take that information and apply it in their practice. So the system is set up to work well, but all it takes is somebody further up the food chain, so to speak, to misuse or skew or manipulate in some way the system and the information in order to get an outcome that serves something other than the broader public on objective science. And this is what we have in healthcare generally. It's not limited to vaccines, but it's perhaps one of the more severe areas in terms of the effect, because innocent children suffer and die. So do adults, but particularly children in the vaccine arena because of this false information. We had, let me see if I can just give you a real quick 30-second run-through of last year, a quick summary. We can go into this in more detail in another show, and I've covered some of this in past shows. But there was a study in 2011 that found for every 1% increase in vaccine coverage, we had 680 additional autism cases. And they controlled for bias, and so in that study, so there it appears to be strongly indicative of a vaccine autism connection. We found from the Coalition for Mercury Free Drugs, COMED, got information through the Freedom of Information Act that shows that CDC and study authors knew and had data that showed that removing mercury from vaccines caused autism rates to decline and continue to decline over a period of years, and they deliberately withheld that data. And the study that resulted was a study that has been touted as being the study that proves that vaccines don't cause autism. Deliberate cover-up of information from the CDC and study authors, and this has now been found out. Now, I don't know if anybody's going to jail over this or not, but they certainly should. That's information that could have saved lives and saved children from severe disabling conditions. And yet,
medical bills and breaking up families and making, you know, affecting siblings as well.
The scope of the damage could never be
very broad.
It's very broad. It is so broad and far-reaching, it could never be quantified. And all the more reason why somebody who knowingly withholds information about medical harm should be severely punished. Those people should be made examples of.
Many, many more medical doctors who are seeing these effects, are they speaking out? Or, you know, they're putting their career on the line when they do so because it's against the grain of the overall powers in the medical community. Are we seeing a resurgence of these people who are willing to do that?
I can't tell from what I've seen, because I think what I'm seeing is not statistically relevant in terms of enough for me to really draw broad conclusions from. But I am seeing in my own, in terms of the information that I encounter on a continual basis, if not as frequent as I would love to see, new names come up, new medical doctors, mm-hmm. new to me, people that I wasn't previously aware of. The alternative vaccine community, at least in terms of the persistent and outspoken players, if you will, it's not a particularly coherent community, but there are players that come up over and over and over again, the people who have been working on this issue for years or even decades. And you'll never know everybody who's doing work in this area. There's always other people you haven't seen, haven't met. But I see a lot of this being one of those players. And so I like to think, and maybe I'm naive in saying this, I like to think I'm familiar with the majority of the more persistently active players. And so I continue to be surprised and pleasantly surprised when I learn about new people, especially if they're medical doctors or researchers, just because those people have a little more clout and sometimes better clarity and insight about the scientific aspects of it. That shouldn't discourage anybody without those credentials from doing whatever they can to help share information and raise awareness.
Absolutely. So let's give folks her name again. It's Dr. Meryl Nass, N-A-S-S. She has a blog called Anthrax Vaccine.
I'm sorry, it's N-A-S-S.
That's what I – did I not say that?
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I thought you – I misheard you then. Maybe it's my phone. Okay, please go ahead.
Maybe I missaid it. Okay. Her blog examines the illogical or dishonest public health responses and now other government policies. So that's why you have to get involved in your state through the NVIC to speak out and find out what other people in your community are doing. Subjects include the U.S. at war, expansion of executive power, anthrax letters case, anthrax vaccine, other vaccines, swine flu and bird flu pandemic responses, and healthcare reform. So she covers a lot of information on her blog, and she links to all the media reports, medical literature, official documents, and other materials complementing her regular website. So this is an abundance of information here. We're going to go on to another topic, I believe.
Yeah, I've got this next one here, Debbie, just as a reminder. When we were in the swine flu pandemic and the immediate aftermath of that, I kept a track of every article I had seen about somebody suffering a severe reaction to the swine flu or someone dying. The FDA and the CDC have said in years past that 90 to 99% of adverse reactions are not reported. A former FDA Commissioner David Kessler was quoted as saying fewer than 1% of adverse drug reactions are reported. We really have no idea what the scope of serious injury and death caused by vaccines is, because when it happens, many times physicians, under the belief that vaccines are safe, will just say, no, this is not related to the vaccine, it's just a coincidence, SIDS happens or whatever it is. So I got to where I had stopped focusing on individual cases, but I brought this one in because I just want to remind people why we do the work that we do, why we seek to find what the truth is about vaccine safety and effectiveness, why we seek to share with people the information that unfortunately but necessarily leads us to believe that we don't get a fully honest and complete story from our government health officials. This is an article about a 7-year-old Vermont girl who died after a flu vaccine. The short story on this one, and this was a very recent case, the short story is that the parents say that we believe in our hearts that it was the flu shot, but of course state officials are saying, well, we don't know that for sure yet, and so forth. And so it'll get spun however it gets spun. I think they're still waiting on the medical examiner to perform an autopsy and give a report somewhere within the next few weeks.
How is it spun? If she had the vaccine, she went home, she got a fever, a headache, and she collapsed and turned blue and stopped breathing in her mother's arms just within days of the vaccine, why can they not make a correlation?
Oh, they can. I mean, you know, if you want my cynical answer, it's they want to see whether or not they can justify saying that we don't know if it's related or it isn't related. But you know, from the legal point of view, in terms of, let's say, vaccine injury cases, there are certain kinds of reactions that if they happen within a certain period of time, that they're presumed to be caused by the vaccine. And if you have injuries or suspected vaccine injuries that fall outside of these so-called table injuries, you know, the ones that fit this predefined table of injuries, then it's not presumed, but you instead have to go into court and make the connection, make the scientific argument that even though this didn't fall on the table of the known or admitted or acknowledged vaccine injuries, this one is nonetheless a vaccine injury as well. So I haven't looked at this from a vaccine injury compensation perspective, mm-hmm. and that's not my area of practice, so I don't know right off the top of my head if that's something that would be a table injury or not. But if it's something that happens very close in time to the vaccine, it's probably a table injury.
And, well, whether or not we can make a confirmation at this time about the connection, there are many people who would say, well, you know what, in there's so many hundreds and thousands of vaccines given, just one person was affected, that's really very small and insignificant. What would you say to somebody who says that? Because I hear that quite a bit.
There's two problems with that. First is what I already said, is that the vast majority of reactions are not even reported. So we have no idea. Nobody has any idea, one way, whatever side of the issue you're on, nobody can say that the risk is some particular percentage or tiny or small. We don't know that. There's no data available, because what we do know is that the overwhelming majority of them are not acknowledged or not reported or not documented. So we have no way of knowing, first of all, whether it's small or not. But what I would also say, for especially with something like the flu shot, who are you to say that I should put my life at risk with a vaccine to prevent somebody else from getting the flu, which for the overwhelming majority of people will be anywhere from minimal to minimal inconvenience to a few days of discomfort. Do people die from flu complications? Of course. People die from car accidents. Should we stop driving? No. I mean, there are, you know, there's inherent uncertainty in being a human being on the planet that is unavoidable. We want to minimize the minimizable risks, the severe risks. But the flu, for most people, is just not a severe risk. And second of all, it's an incalculable risk from the vaccine. We don't know how safe it is. What we do know is there's a potential for death. Now, if you believe in the vaccines and you want to have a vaccine and you feel safer with a vaccine, I think you should have the right to do that. I might personally question your choice, but my professional view is that we should all have the right to make our mind and make whatever choice we want to make. But to go so far as to say that my choice is somehow a risk to you is really stretching it, because if vaccines are reasonably safe and effective, then the odds are far greater than not that your vaccine will protect you, and then I'm no risk to you whether I'm vaccinated or not. But whether I should risk my life on a vaccine or my child's life on the chance that your vaccine won't work is really silly.
Right. So I was going to say that specifically, that's what the point of this show is all about, that we're not conclusively saying we're scientists or physicians with that information. We're giving you the data that we find out there, the news articles and information. But this show is really about you becoming aware, listeners becoming aware and educated, making decisions and take the responsibility of your health for yourself, and actually having the right to make the choice whether or you do or do not want to have you or your children vaccinated. That is really the essence of what we're doing here.
But the other piece that gets left out of that equation, Debbie, because the people on the pro
activists, right? Go ahead.
Well, people who take the pro-vaccine side, they want to frame it as, you know, should you risk the vaccine or risk the disease? And of course, the vaccine is safe except for these, you know, very very rare and really non-existent, you know, adverse reactions, and that's
right.
Better than risking the disease. Aside from the fact that there's no data available to make that comparison, that's an improper framing of the question in the first place, because there are other things we can do that are safer, more effective than vaccines, less expensive than vaccines. So why are we doing vaccines? Only because we've been brainwashed into believing that this is the only thing that works and that it does, in fact, work. You know, homeoprophylaxis.
Thank you for that.
Oh, sure. You know, homeoprophylaxis, of course, as we've discussed, vitamin D supplements, studies show that that works better than flu vaccines at preventing flu. I learned from an herbalist just last night that there is, and I don't remember the specific scientific term, but I'll just say, forgive me for the word here, but there are ingredients in certain kinds of foods that are protective against the HPV virus. So
you're not allowed to say that?
Pardon me?
You're not allowed to say that?
No. I don't remember the specific ingredient, the scientific term that she gave for it, but they're in certain foods. I think she was saying broccoli and cabbage or some things like that. So forgive me for the lack of precision, but the point is that there are other safer, more effective ways and less costly ways of dealing with the risk and threat of disease. And we should be, if it were only a question of which is safer, the vaccine or the disease, or which is a greater risk, we don't have data to answer that. But it's not only a question of that. It's a question of what are the other options for dealing with infectious disease concerns. And the answer to that question is there are many options, and we therefore should not be limited to somebody else's decision for us about what is the best option for us.
I'm here, yes. Okay. So I agree. Very powerful information that people should take home and ruminate, think about it, decide whether they really need to go out and get more information and talk to other people. So I'm kind of trying to find out that ingredient, GP120. I don't know whether that's it, but let me see what it says here. By immunized defensive childhood influenza vaccination and sequela, containing adjuvants. It's from Joseph Mercola, science-based medicine. So this is against him, probably. I'm not sure. Because, you know, there are a lot of websites that say that the information that alternative and complementary practitioners are talking about is not for real, but it can certainly be just suppressed information. Anyway, let's go ahead and talk about the fears over fabricated research data.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. Didn't mean to roll over there, Debbie. This comes from a poll, I believe in the UK, that they said more than 1 in 10, in fact, 13% of scientists and doctors have witnessed colleagues intentionally altering or fabricating data. And this you know, just supports nicely what Dr. Angel, it's A-N-G-E-L-L, and forgive me, I don't know the correct pronunciation of that. I'm just going to say Angel because I like that word. But what she was saying in terms of, you know, not being able anymore to rely on published research, and here is a real good reason why. Now, this is 13% of scientists or doctors who are willing to admit in a poll that they have witnessed colleagues intentionally. Now, this is I added the other part in there, willing to admit. I wonder, because of the high pressure in the medical world to conform with the system, whether this 13% might potentially represent a larger percent in reality. But in any case, according to the poll, 13%.
Right, because it's their livelihood. It's called publish or perish. Either you publish or you don't. So they can tweak the information a little bit to make it look like what it's supposed to come out as to confirm whatever it is they made a hypothesis about, I presume.
Right, but I'm thinking if someone acknowledges in a poll that they've seen this, that they may be taking a risk. So I'm wondering if the 13% represents a higher number. Because there may be people who have seen fabrication who aren't going to admit it.
I see. So you don't feel as if this poll was completely anonymous? Perhaps if somebody
I don't have any information about the poll. I'm just pointing out that what I hear over and over again from my healthcare worker clients, doctors and nurses and others, is that the work environment in the medical community is highly militant. It's highly suppressive. You're not allowed to think for yourself, buck the system, say anything, think independently. You're supposed to do what you're told and shut up. And I hear this not just from the nurses.
Or they'll tattle against you, I guess.
Well, no, you lose your job. You know, if you're going to make waves, you're out of here. And this is the mentality. And I hear this. I've never heard anybody say, no, it's not like that here where I work. Every healthcare worker I've spoken to has confirmed for me, and I talk to healthcare workers around the country. So it appears to me that on the whole, the medical work environment is a repressive one. Now, I'm sure there are exceptions to that, and I'm sure there are people that feel very comfortable in their jobs. I'm not suggesting it's an absolute condition. I am saying that I hear over and over again, with no variation, from my healthcare worker clients around the country that this is the state. Now, that's a different thing than researchers. I've been dealing with healthcare workers and not researchers. But as you just pointed it out, the publisher parish, as it's known, is a strong incentive to, you know, tweak something here and there, but that's a slippery slope. Once you cross that line, no matter how minimal initially, especially if you recognize after doing it some that you get away with it and it works and it pays, you know, you actually get the promotion or job or whatever it is you're looking for because you got published. And then that leads to the slippery slope. And the classic example of that we've talked about in recent shows is Paul Thorson, headed up studies for the CDC, among other things, the ones that the CDC points to say, look, see, here's proof that vaccines don't cause autism. And he was indicted last April on 13 counts of fraud with the CDC, 9 counts of money laundering. He may very well have started with just one simple little slip, and it profited him, so he did some more slips. And before you know it, he's making a whole career based on fraud. And, you know, fortunately for him, it caught up to him.
Watch that first step. It's the biggest one.
Yeah, even though it looks the smallest. So how many other people are doing that and haven't gotten caught? Well, here's a poll that says, you know, 13% of scientists or doctors have seen this happen. So it's really quite disturbing. But something to, you know, let our viewers know that when we say that we distrust the medical literature, we are not just random radicals, you know, arbitrarily throwing something out there to create sensationalism. We are reporting on real information that has real effects on people's lives.
Right. So let's talk about 14 new side effects that are found on widely prescribed swine flu drug, which they say everybody should get, Tamiflu.
Tamiflu, the producers of Tamiflu probably made a fortune second only to that of the swine flu vaccine manufacturers during the swine flu pandemic. It was widely prescribed, and now this article says that thousands of people in Britain who took Tamiflu during the swine flu pandemic have suffered a string of side effects that they were not warned about. 14 new adverse reactions added to the drug's profile in November, more than 2 years after the scare.
So those were not listed on the original pamphlet that comes inside of the package?
Apparently not. And
which tells us that the drugs were not properly tested, or this information was not printed on the label.
Right. And the Cochrane collaboration, which we've talked about a lot in connection with vaccines, they are going to release their findings on Wednesday. That may be this past Wednesday. This article is from 3 or 4 days ago.
January 15th.
Yeah,
it's only 5 days ago, so we're going to hear something.
So we may have there may already be information out there then from the Cochrane collaboration that says they are going to claim that the drugs makers, and I don't know how to pronounce this one
Roche,
either.
Roche.
Okay, thank you. Withheld vital data during its investigation. This, unfortunately, is a story we hear over and over again in the pharmaceutical industry, too.
They withheld. It wasn't that they didn't know. They knew. And this is unethical.
You know, I keep thinking about the tobacco industry issue and whether or not nicotine causes cancer and so forth that played out a few decades ago. And I remember seeing on television a row of tobacco industry CEOs, one at a time, getting up. There must have been at least 6 or 7 of them. Each one got up one at a time and said, cigarettes do not cause cancer. Cigarettes do not cause cancer. Cigarettes do not cause cancer. And they all, it turns out, had information prior to that showing that cigarettes cause cancer. They fought that for as long as they could until public opinion finally turned because the information and evidence was just overwhelming and undeniable. But it was long after there was credible information that it was widely accepted by the government and the general public. I think we're going to see the same thing with vaccines ultimately,
right,
and perhaps with pharmaceutical, other pharmaceuticals, when we see as we are headed down a path that is very troubling in many respects, but is also encouraging insofar
mm-hmm.
as there are more and more lights being
exactly.
shown on what's really going on in the pharmaceutical industry, not with just with vaccines, but in other issues, information
yeah.
being suppressed and so forth.
I'm with you right there. I was saying the cover-up, it's slowly the veils are coming off, and we're each little bit of information is going to add up until you do hit that tipping point where something's going to hit the ground and say, okay, we've had enough of this, and now it's time to change whatever system is in place. Dr. Bob is on the chat today. He said 29 girls in Syracuse have been found to have Tourette syndrome after the Gardasil vaccine, which is suspect in their brain damage. So we've talked about that, I think, on our last show. And so as more and more of these cases come out and people are seeing it on the news and it can't be covered up, for instance, what we've just talked about, the evidence from the swine flu making thousands of people ill with symptoms that were not disclosed. So these types of things, I believe the entire world has fallen into a state of skepticism. That's my belief.
Well,
and, you know, we better look at the time.
We're moving in that direction.
Okay.
We've got a long ways to go. But, yes, I've got to slide out of here in just a few moments, but I wanted
okay.
to just make a real quick acknowledgement here. Dr. Bob has been a regular on the chat in sharing information, and we don't always have time to get to or discuss his chat contributions, but I did want to take just a quick moment to thank him for his regular participation ongoing with this show and for his contributions, and we do our best to keep up with those and to bring them in. So thanks, Debbie, for doing that this time. And
we covered a lot of ground today. We talked about compensation for narcolepsy and the swine flu. We talked about a girl dying after the flu shot, a fabricated research data, and 14 new side effects that were found from the swine flu, a drug called Tamiflu. And we did not get to the business about what's going on in India, which is a big vaccine story, and a couple of other things. So we can talk about that on the next show. We have 1 minute left, so do give Alan a call if you have any questions about vaccine exemptions, waivers, and your rights, and take a look at his e-guide, which can be found on the Pandemic Flu Vaccine website, or send us a message and we'll give you a link. And so next Thursday we will be back on our regular time and date at noon. That would be, let's see, if I open the calendar, that would be the 26th of January. So I'm going to say goodbye. And Alan, if you want to say a last word, that would be great.
Well, just to let people know that there's a wealth of information at homeopathyworldcommunity.com about homeopathy and about vaccines and your rights at vaccinerights.com. And I do work with people around the country. People a lot of times call me and say, you're in North Carolina, I don't know if you can help me. And most of the time I can with people around the country in a wide variety of different kinds of vaccine exemption waiver issues. But I welcome calls or emails in any event.
Okay, thanks for listening to Homeopathy World Community.
Thank you for listening to Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S. with co-hosts Alan Phillips and Debbie Brook on Homeopathy World Community Radio. Remember to educate before you vaccinate.
Allow our souls to shine, reaching for the great new love and healing for mankind. Share your light, let your love be unfurled. One by one, we are changing the world. It takes an act of loving will to cause a change to be. So light your inner candle and ever guard its flame. And as its radiance grows brighter, to the world it will proclaim. Share your light, let your truth be unfurled. One by one we are free. Share your light, let your truth be unfurled.